Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. You know the drill. We're recording on Tuesday. Oh, the day that New York is going to choose who will replace George Santos. I can't wait to hear what the decision is, but we'll all discuss it on the next day. We spend a lot of time talking about immigration because we cover Texas every week with Scott Braddock of the Quorum Report. I'm always looking at issues that happen on the border. But of course, my governor went down to hold Greg Abbott's hand the other day when they're challenging the feds about the Texas-Mexico border. And I saw something really interesting about how Governor Greg Abbott has sort of changed his language over the last couple of years. So I thought I would share this with you. In the aftermath of the El Paso mass shooting, which was committed by a man fueled by anti-immigrant ideology, Abbott had refrained from using words like invasion when he spoke about migrants. These days, it's a word he uses freely and a lot. Go back to the idea, the El Paso mass shooting was committed by a man fueled by anti-immigrant ideology. I wonder what Abbott is fueling. You know it, and so do I. So we go to Slate.com all the time. And when we go to Slate, we usually hang out with Mark Joseph Stern, who we adore, and we're covering politics and the judiciary. But this article caught my attention. Maybe it's because I'm the daughter of two public school teachers, and my daughter is a teacher, and I've actually been in the classroom on many occasions. And it was entitled, "The Loss of Things I Took for Granted." 10 years into my college teaching career, students stopped being able to read effectively. Now, Adam, I want to make sure I pronounce your name correctly. Adam Kotzko?
Yep.
Okay. He's on the faculty of the Shimmer Great Book School at North Central College, where he teaches widely in the humanities and social sciences. His research focuses on political theology, continental philosophy, and the history of Christian thought. Your piece was not surprising. I think almost anyone in academia, I don't care whether it's even Harvard or whether it's the local community college, will tell you that they've experienced the same thing. And as I was reading your piece, I will tell you I started to cry. Because now more than ever, we need to be more informed. We need to be more engaged. We need to be able to understand complex concepts. And because now there's so much misinformation, if you're not curious and don't know where to look, you'll be so easily manipulated. So more than ever, we need a really sort of robust educational system. And in your piece, Adam, you sort of point to a little bit of a pivot point with the rise of the cell phone, you know, the great distraction. So before I let you talk, I wanted to share a story I heard from elementary school teachers a number of years ago. And they were elementary, so that meant they were kindergarten through, you know, sixth grade. And they were complaining about, believe it or not, Sesame Street. And why were they complaining about Sesame Street? Because it was really hard to engage their kindergartners, first and second graders, because they couldn't compete with Sesame Street. That they would be a little more boring, that they would be a little less entertaining, that they would be a little bit less funny. And so all of a sudden, the challenge for them in the classroom was that they had to sort of look at Sesame Street to figure out how they could sort of make their classroom that way, but that isn't necessarily the way that they were going to be able to teach effectively. So they were looking at Sesame Street going, damn it, look what I have to compete with now. And think about that. We celebrate Sesame Street, and yet these teachers saw it as a challenge in some ways and almost as a threat to what they were doing in the classroom. Not that they shouldn't improve what they were doing in the classroom, but they basically said, I can't be that entertaining. I just don't have the time, energy, and capacity to do it. And then I thought about this, and then I was reading your article, and I'm going, oh my God, it was a cakewalk back then. The challenge for the teachers today is overwhelming. And I don't think, one, we appreciate it. We haven't reinforced the supports they need. We haven't paid them for what we expect them to do. And surely in so many ways, we are undermining what is going to be essential, which is the accomplishment of kids coming out of both high school as well as college. So let me welcome you to the program, Adam, and describe what you're seeing and what you attribute it to, because you talk about it in ways where you are not blaming the students, because in so many ways, it's the setting that they've been put in, but you are looking at a system that is really setting them up to fail.
Right. Yeah, I think that That's important, and that's something that I wanted to get out of the way immediately as I'm writing, that I'm not doing a kids these days type of critique, that I'm not indulging in those kind of intergenerational cliches, that what I want to do is support students and kind of stop this from happening to them. They don't choose the school they get to go to. They don't choose the pedagogy. They're doing the best with what they have. And so basically what happened is I started to notice, like probably about 5 years ago, so actually before the pandemic started, that it felt as though there was just like a kind of cliff where students were not as capable of handling long readings. That if the reading was much over 10 pages, even if they did it, somehow that length was intimidating and they just couldn't process it all. I also noticed difficulties with reading out loud in the classroom, which is a typical part of my pedagogy and the Great Books program, and just simply stopping at unfamiliar words and not even attempting it, instead of the typical like, oh, it sounded out, you know. And so cell phones have been a reality the whole time I've been teaching. And these changes started to happen before the pandemic, and that's another typical kind of turning point in people's mind for when like students' educational attainment decreased. And I started to do more research, and there was actually a change in reading pedagogy that started de-emphasizing phonics and just kind of relying on students to kind of figure it out on their own. To just recognize words and they'll get it, they'll pick it up by osmosis or something like that. And the goal was to, as far as I can tell, to get them more enthusiastic about the idea of reading without as much attention to the nitty-gritty details of how to actually go about doing it.
And yet, at the same time, so you talk about sort of the disappearance of phonics and the idea of sounding a word out, which we were always encouraged to do. And think about it. And you would also want to learn, was it from the Italian or was it from the French? And was it, so it's again, so words became not necessarily a threat, but something that you could both sound out and maybe even learn a little bit about that word. So we're almost saying that somehow words are the enemy.
Yeah, that's.
Which is unbelievable because, in fact, you want the opposite. So instead of being curious, you kind of looked at it and said, "Well, I don't know it, so I'll move on." But that's not what teaching's about.
Yeah, I think that it's kind of a strange thing because we all know that English is not as phonetic of a language as it could be, right? We know that the spelling is often arbitrary and some words are genuinely hard to pronounce. But it's also not a pictographic language. It's like we shouldn't just leave that tool on the table when it's such a powerful one and can get us so far. You know, like students can see a word they've never seen in print, but they have heard it spoken. You know, like by breaking the knowledge of phonics, you kind of break that connection and the kind of like ease of translation between writing and reading, which is really one of the signature benefits of phonetic writing in the first place.
So as I was reading your piece, you know what I kept thinking about? How so St. Paul's, one of the most expensive private schools, elite private schools in the world, is in my town. And what I think about is that what does St. Paul's encourage that we see the opposite of in public school? So for example, they do not teach to the test at St. Paul's. Not at all. And you mentioned teaching to the test. And I think we need to talk a little bit about that. How do we evaluate children? How do we evaluate schools? How do we evaluate whether, academic performance is, being met, and the return to the SAT and all this stuff. But teaching to the test, especially when you realize how often kids are being tested, what is it, second grade, fourth grade, there, every couple of years, and you want the kids to achieve, you also want it because it might have an impact on the kind of funding your school might get. But explain to my audience why teaching for the test might also be undermining a child's ability to actually have a robust learning experience.
Yeah, I think there's been a huge change in this, and it's kind of a familiar narrative. But you know, when I was in high school, like in the 90s, I believe that we did like a statewide kind of standardized test assessment over the course of 2 days out of our entire like high school career. That was my memory of it. And there was no set kind of preparation for it. It was just like a pure diagnostic. It didn't have any consequences for our life. And since the advent of No Child Left Behind under President Bush, the stakes of testing got higher and higher. And instead of being a diagnostic that you just kind of drop in and see where they are, schools tried to game the results by giving students very specific instruction about how to handle the test itself. And I hear from educators right now that it's taking 2 to 3 weeks out of the semester sometimes. 2 to 3 weeks of like real instructional time is lost to this for the prep for the test, much less the test itself. So I talk about in the article that the testing is kind of cannibalizing the teaching time that it's supposed to be kind of assessing. And I do think that having some type of external measure, having some type of check, it makes sense to have that. But it's been so overemphasized and so exaggerated, and the incentives have been lined up so terribly that now I think it's also a contributor to the decline in reading, because schools are quite literally only assigning readings of the length that can appear on a standardized test.
And they're only assigning the topics that are being tested.
Right.
So if this is not a tested topic, like some aspect of social studies or some aspect of whatever, they're not going to teach it to you because they're not being tested on this, as if
Yeah.
you don't need that topic. Well, I mean, it's like, so I go back to I grew up on Long Island, and I was I, Hicksville actually, and I had a teacher. Listen to the books I was assigned in 8th grade. This is the books my teacher assigned. Kristin Lavrin's Daughter by Sigrid Undset and Sholem Aleichem's Tevye's Daughters. Now, today, nobody would assign those books, okay? Because, like, how would that do on the test? You know what I'm saying? And yet, I go back and I'm so grateful for what he was able to turn me on to, names I had never heard of, books that were like, they could have been, stops to keep a door open. They were so thick, but yet they were so exciting and they took me places I would never have gone. But they won't go there today because you're not being tested on where those books take you. And so
Right.
I think the standardized test is so important, which is why, again, I mentioned St. Paul's. They don't do that. They don't do that. In addition to which, you hear all this emphasis you mentioned about STEM. So talk a little bit about STEM, and not that you're trashing STEM, but that, the emphasis on STEM also is undermining a robust education.
Yeah, I think that from my perspective, the issue with STEM isn't that the value of the subjects was just obvious. The issue is that the emphasis on them, the one-sided emphasis on them, kind of further cuts the emphasis on reading, because STEM fields tend to be fields where the practitioners believe that there's just kind of this neutral information that can just be conveyed, and that reading is more a purely utilitarian activity, that you're like delivering content. And the kind of humanities approach to reading, where you're dwelling on the text itself and its unique language and kind of the capabilities of expression that language has, that falls by the wayside in those fields, appropriately for what they're trying to do, but it can't be everything that we're doing.
They don't just emphasize the STEM. What do they de-emphasize? That, things, classes like humanities or languages or art or theater, they will be sacrificed to make sure that the STEM has been reinforced and those other courses get short shrift. I mean, that's the other thing too. It's not like I don't want to make that choice. I mean, I want to celebrate both,
Yeah.
but that's not what we're given. We're not given both. We're given a choice, and now the choice is that STEM will make us better workers, prepare us for the workplace. After all, what could you possibly imagine if you had studied something like, why would you have studied Latin? Why would you have studied French? Why would you have done art? What good would that have done you? And yet they find out, for example, that musicians are really good at math. Learn to play an instrument and you're a better mathematician. No, who would have thunk it? Well, actually, you would have. Adam.
Right.
And yet we don't see how we could be enhancing STEM. We only see them as a threat to STEM.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a shame, because it gives people an impoverished view of science itself, that we get that that science is a kind of repository of known facts that you need to memorize, and that people don't even get the tools to think scientifically in kind of an authentic and open-ended way. So yeah, that it impoverishes the STEM fields themselves too.
What about, so you mentioned, obviously we cannot ignore what happened during the pandemic. So if you saw this cliff before the pandemic, Adam, we now know the cliff is now turned into something like you're falling off of Mount Everest, and the learning loss is remarkable. But you take that learning loss on top of what you've already described, and I'm trying to figure out how you claw back, especially when you see the assault on public education. So take all this, I mean, we're making a toxic brew, because you know, you've got the pandemic, you've got all the things that you said that led up to before even the pandemic, and now you have vouchers and charters and money being drained out of public education, and now you have book banning, and you have, you know, what is it, the discomfort, whatever Ron DeSantis calls it, you know, you can't teach about certain things like race and gender. And you look at all this, and everything is moving in a direction where what you write about today is nothing compared to what we will be writing about 5 years from now, because we're not moving towards a knowledgeable society. We're moving towards one that seems to almost be challenged by knowledge.
Mm-hmm. It is a definite challenge. And I'm kind of hopeful that the more crass kind of book ban politics are failing, you know, that it, I'm hopeful that that aspect of it will be a flash in the pan, and that parents will realize, we can't just let these maniacs take over our schools. Like, this is crazy. And I think that is what's happening in a lot of communities. That's one benefit of local control of schools, I suppose. I think that it's definitely the case that people are more likely to be offended when you present them with facts than to be appreciative. Oh, wow, I learned something new. This is great. Like, that's not...
Exactly.
I mean, sometimes it seems like people are offended by the idea that there is a fact of the matter. You know,
yeah.
Like, it just seems as though this is another aspect that, I mean, this is a whole different conversation. Maybe we can have another conversation about this, but the incentives of social media in particular to have a kind of very emotive, very kind of in-group signaling form of communication that doesn't have that argumentative structure and doesn't have kind of a grounding in fact.
So maybe what we need to do, so again, I told you about that teacher who had me read Klitzen Lavrin's Daughter. And it was a difficult teacher. Let me trust me on this one. Even we had a love-hate relationship. But one of the things that I realized after graduating from high school, so I went to school in Minnesota at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Yeah, sure, you betcha. And I'm in my political science class. And in my political science class, I kept raising my hand. And finally, one of the students after the second week says, "We don't question the teacher." And I went, "Excuse me?" And I suddenly realized I'd been taught by the Socratic method. And I didn't know that's what it was. But it turned out that's what it was. And maybe in some ways, if we want to start getting them out of their cell phones, being more curious, all these other things, that maybe we need to start embracing the Socratic method. Because maybe we need to sort of encourage that dialogue, that challenge, that level of conversation that really feels like it's disappearing. You mentioned social media, but social media sort of tells you what to think. And what the Socratic method does the opposite in some ways. It sort of makes you want to think. And maybe what I had experienced, which I didn't even know is that was what I was experiencing until I got to college, but maybe that's part of the way that we can start to sort of repair some of this educational loss by encouraging this ability to be curious and think and to even challenge and let
Right.
them know that they have a right to challenge.
This is a perfect setup for my self-understanding as an educator in the Scheimer Great Books program that you mentioned. We're very Socratic in our teaching style. It's not just debate, it's text-centered. Like, we have a shared center of what we're trying to understand and what we're trying to work out, and we hold each other accountable to that. And even though I've had to retool my teaching to have like shorter readings, it's still like it's absolutely essential to have that center of authority outside of me, but also outside of any of the individual students and their experience, to get them kind of thinking in broader terms, to get them thinking empathetically for other points of view, to get them modeling what a good argument looks like and what a good counter argument looks like. And thankfully, my students do still read well enough that we could still basically do this, but it can be a
But of
challenge.
all the places, let me tell you what frightens me. Because again, describe where you're teaching. If the reason where you're teaching is the great books, obviously books is the invitation. Reading is the sort of raison d'être, all these things. And now you're telling me that these kids sometimes are challenged by 20 pages. And I'm like, well, then why the hell did you do great books? I mean, it sort of surprises me that of all the places where you teach, that you would see this, because I would have imagined the opposite, that if there was a core group of college students who would really be committed to the written word, who would want to be curious about reading, it would be them. And then to have you write this piece and for you to tell me these stories, if it's bad for you, what's it like for the rest of academia? Oh my God, Adam, there, that's, this is, I mean, again, it sort of just hit me like this is even more shocking when you realize what
Yikes.
you teach.
It's true. And I think that
Oh
even
my
the students who
goodness.
are very motivated to do the great books side of it, they're more attracted to it as a learning community and as an ability. They're more attracted to the pedagogy than they are to the text aspect of it, which even those students continue to struggle with.
You write in your piece, and I want to read this because there were certain nuggets I pulled out. You write, finally, every generation thinks the younger generation is failing to make the grade, except for the current cohort of professors, who are by and large more invested in their students' success and mental health and more responsive to students' needs than any group of educators in human history. We are not complaining about our students. We are complaining about what has been taken away from them. That line just shook me to the core because it is being, it, they have been denied. I talk about my kid all the time, the one who's teaching, because she's been teaching all over the world and now she's teaching in America. So she taught in China, she taught in Japan, she taught in Sweden, she taught in Norway. And she has never been a teacher here. And I will tell you right now, she's horrified. She's horrified about what's not being taught. She's horrified about the challenge of being a teacher. She's shocked at the pushback from parents that are speaking out of ignorance and not out of knowledge. And fear the unknown as opposed to being curious about it. And I was telling someone the other day that, it's Chinese New Year. So she was bringing in the serpent and all the sort of the red and what's it for and what is the Chinese New Year's and the different, difference between the Lunar New Year and the Chinese New Year. And a parent called the principal and said that my daughter was indoctrinating her children in Chinese religion. All right. So she just looked, she said, the Chinese don't do religion, at least not under this administration. And it's just, but it was, but that's what happened. Instead of being excited that she was bringing her knowledge of the world into this first grade classroom, she was being told that she was indoctrinating children. So part of the problem I have too with your article is not, I have a problem with it, is that not only are we setting these kids up to fail, we're telling teachers not to teach. And that combination doesn't give me hope. So I hope more people read your article. I shared it with a lot of people, and I hope we start thinking. And for those of us who care about democracy, we're actually going to have to care a lot about what you write about. Because ultimately, democracy will not thrive if we can't read a headline, we can't read a book, we can't read a constitutional amendment, because otherwise we'll be an uninformed voter. And then you know what happens. I think we're seeing it right now. Thank you so much for doing this, Adam.
Thank you.
Adam Kosko writes for Slate.com, and the title of his piece was "The Loss of Things I Took for Granted." 10 years into my college teaching career, students stopped being able to read effectively. Again, thank you so much. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. Producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Something strange is happening in our politics. We have, on the one hand, all of this bad news for the Democratic Party. Biden is too old. The poll numbers show he's losing. The Senate map isn't good. The Republicans still control the House. And on the other hand, the Democrats keep winning elections, going back to the 2022 midterms when the Republicans dramatically underperformed. And in every special election since, most recently last night, where in a seat previously held by, of all people, George Santos, The Democrat Tom Suozzi won by almost 8 points. Now, this was a district that went for Biden, but it elected a Republican congressperson in 2022. And here, the Democrat won by 8 points. And I know the excuses the Republicans can make. Well, it was snowing, and that hurt Republican turnout. That's probably true. But the way you win elections is by getting more votes than the other guy, and they failed to do that. Suozzi was a particularly strong candidate for that district. That's true. Sometimes the Democrats nominate strong candidates, and they win. But it should be noted the Republicans had a very strong candidate as well, somebody with a great personal story, somebody whose views on social issues were not far right, and she lost by 8 points. Now, I don't know that this predicts much about who's going to win the presidency or much else about the future, but it does show that the poll numbers can be deceiving. The Democrats have strengths here, and they keep winning elections, and that can't be ignored altogether either. The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell Minute or subscribe to my Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln.
When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history. When your parents lived through things that looked so much like this. All the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place. And you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance. When you know for many people this will be their last chance. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth. When you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth. When they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before. When Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news. When the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do? When the time to act is now, and now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We continue to record on Tuesday morning. So, you know, we spend a lot of time with Texas, and it's not just Scott Braddock and the Quorum Report that we do. We actually interview a lot of folks in the Texas Observer, the Houston Chronicle, and my good friend Barbara Radnofsky decided that I should definitely interview Chris Tomlinson. She said, he's fabulous. And I said, well, then I will seek him out. Chris Tomlinson writes commentary about money, politics, and life in Texas for Hearst newspapers. The Texas Association of Managing Editors awarded him Columnist of the Year in 2021, and the Headliners Foundation named him Texas's Star Opinion Writer, and he's on my show. How exciting. He's also authored two New York Times bestsellers, Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth, and Tomlinson Hill, the remarkable story of two families who share the Tomlinson name, one white, one black. And before joining the Houston Chronicle, he spent 20 years with the Associated Press. Let me welcome you to the program, Mr. Tomlinson. Thank you so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure. So I originally wanted to talk a little bit about Elon Musk. Oh, God, no, I never want to talk about him. But unfortunately, when he's the richest man on the planet, you have no choice. And you had written a piece about Elon, and it was entitled, Abbott-appointed billionaire helping Elon Musk acquire sensitive Texas parkland for SpaceX. Well, blow me away with a feather. Like, that should shock me. But before we get into that piece, I want to talk about something else, because when there's been so much activity now on the border because of what Governor Abbott is doing, and now he's basically flipping the bird at the feds, and he's bringing all the he brought 25 of the 26 Republican governors to sort of do a kumbaya on the border, and you know, he spent billions of dollars trying to, you know, what was it, Operation Lone Star, I think that's what it's called, and they spent billions of dollars, and we've seen an increase in the number of people crossing the border. So obviously Texas, he've just wasted $8 billion or how much money he spent. But I don't think people understand our relationship with Mexico. And I don't think they understand the economic relationship. They don't understand the familial relationship. They don't understand what we buy, what they sell, how important they are to our economy. And so you had written a piece just before this entitled, "Closing the Texas-Mexico Border Would Ruin Super Bowl Parties and the U.S. Economy." Very clever to include the Super Bowl. But explain to my audience something that they probably know very little about. You know, they know that they're told to fear something. They don't even understand what the benefit may be from that relationship and how important it is to our economy and our ability to function. So with that, Mr. Tomlinson, thank you so much again. And let's start with something that is paid a lot of attention, especially will be in Republican politics. It'll be the thing they ride into the sunlight in November of 2024. It's both the immigration problem, but it's also our problem and our understanding of our relationship with Mexico. So since you write about finance and economics, I think you'd be the best person to enlighten us.
Sure. Well, you know, when we look at the city of Eagle Pass, where Governor Abbott has built his border barrier, it's where he's interfering with Customs and Border Protection from doing their jobs. It's a place where $3.54 billion of beer alone crosses that one border point every year. You know, almost all of our avocados, almost all of our tomatoes come from Mexico. So that's it's no lie. I mean, there would be no guacamole at any Super Bowl party if we closed the border with Mexico. You know, but seriously, Mexico is now our largest trade partner. We do more trade with Mexico than we do with China now. And that's absolutely critical to our economy.
As I walk through Walmart, which I never do, but if I walk through Costco, which I never do, everyone keeps saying, oh, made in Mexico, made in Mexico. Here's the problem with the avocados. They don't say made in Mexico. I mean, think about all the beer. I mean, it's like so many of the products that we may be getting, the fruits, the vegetables, the beer, the whatever. The beauty of China is that you can sort of see it because it says made in China. And yet what you're telling me now, that they are a bigger trading partner than China, I think would shock people, would absolutely shock people, because they know about China. They're, again, told that they're sort of our economic enemy, you know, because they're so robust, because they make everything, because they, I mean, we knew during the pandemic with the, you know, the face shields, you know, that China was the ones that was making it. We didn't make them anymore. But I think to know that it's Mexico would be such a shock to the system that, again, it might begin to tailor how we view our relationship with them and maybe try to figure something out other than fearing people that are coming across the border here because of freedom and to work, and also to look at Mexico as somehow they're the problem when, in fact, they're so much of an asset for our own economy.
Well, I mean, there's so much racism informing the average American's view of Mexico. You know, we think of it as a poor country when, in fact, it's a middle-income country. You go to Mexico City and it's as big and as vibrant as New York City. It is the financial capital of Latin America. You know, we would not have an auto industry without the parts that are made in China. The average American-made car will cross the border with Mexico three times before it's completed. There's so much more to it than the border. There's a great deal of wealth. In addition to them being our largest trade partner in terms of what we import, they're also one of our largest customers for our finished goods that we export. You know, we look at these images of desperate people along the border, and we think of Mexico as a desperate, poor country. But most of those people are not from Mexico. As we reduce our reliance on China, we will become far more dependent on Mexico. So it's high time that we begin to change our perspective.
What also about the worker relationship? Because you have, I mean, I look at people that live in New Hampshire and work in Vermont, and people that live in Vermont that work in New Hampshire, and people in so I see a very fluid, porous border because there are no borders. It's the United States. But there is also a really, I think, important understanding of the relationship of work between what's going on, especially in places like, I mean, we're talking about the U.S. economy being the largest trading partner, but let's talk about its impact on Texas. And my audience has heard me tell the story a million times. I will apologize to them, but not to you. When we went down to do cleanup after Katrina, we were in New Orleans and they were selling t-shirts, Chris. And you know what the t-shirts said? The t-shirts had FEMA. And at that time it meant find every Mexican available. Okay. So they were using them as basically the way to rebuild the city. I mean, I remember going into New Orleans and going, wow, everyone's speaking Spanish. I was like so surprised. And yet that was as a result of Katrina. But there is a dynamic between Texas and Mexico that is so vibrant, whether it's the restaurants or manufacturing or whatever. And it's almost like, are they going to ignore that? Are they going to think that once those people disappear, that somehow they can maintain their own economy? What about Texas and Mexico?
You know, I grew up here and we used to walk across the border almost freely without hindrance. I mean, the Mexican border protection people would just wave us through, and on our way back, you know, we'd have our driver's license ready, but there was almost no controls. Today, you know, it's much stricter because of concerns about terrorism and security, but still 40% of the workforce in Texas border cities are Mexican nationals who live in Mexico and cross a bridge every morning. A huge number of Americans live in the border towns on the Mexican side because life is cheaper there. You can get a nicer house. Things are less expensive. And they cross the border every morning to come to work. And even if we are going to narrow it down to the undocumented workers, 8% of the Texas workforce is undocumented. And the one thing you will never hear a Republican politician talk about is cracking down on U.S. employers of undocumented workers, because the construction industry, the oil and gas industry rely on those workers who are highly skilled but undocumented. And any attempt to crack down on those companies would cause big problems with the donors to the GOP down here.
So maybe we should talk about them, because I remember when Scott Braddock was educating me about Texas and especially about Houston, he told me something that was actually shocking because I didn't realize the number. He said that in Houston, in the greater Houston area, there are about 600,000 undocumented immigrants. The state of Vermont is about 600,000. Okay, the entire state. So this is the entire state of Vermont is hanging out in Houston right about now. And the reason I want to talk about this is that they're not a burden to Houston, that they are essential to Houston. And isn't it interesting that Abbott is focusing on the people coming across, but not focusing on the people that are here that he claims are undocumented and are exhausting our system and, you know, draining our tax coffers and doing all these negative things. And the reason, as you point out, he won't, is because they're too important to the oil and coal and gas industry. They're too important to the restaurant industry. They're too important to the hospital industry. I think we need to call his bluff. Because the only way people understand how vital it is and how important, and with an aging demographic, even more essential now than ever, is to basically say, well, you know what? You got a problem at home, honey. If this is really what you claim is the problem, how come you haven't addressed it? Just the way he hasn't addressed rape, Chris Tomlinson. Remember, he was going to get rid of all the rapists because that was going to deal with the exception for abortion. Well, you know what? All the rapists haven't disappeared, and there turns out to be how many thousands of babies born from rapists. So my question for you, Chris, is that you've been in Texas a long time. You walked across the border. I've only been there one day, you know, my whole life. But I just keep thinking we need to begin to figure out how to push back. And the best way to push back is to say, well, if this is a problem, why haven't you focused on what's wrong here? If you claim it's wrong. And he won't. And he won't. And how come nobody does that, Chris?
Well, I mean, we saw that with the bipartisan immigration bill that Republicans in the House of Representatives sank last week.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. That was a true and good effort to fix our broken asylum system because it is broken. It's 40 years old. and the thing about our migrants, our asylum system, is that it victimizes the migrants as it does, as much as it does anyone else, because it gives false hope. The truth is, they do not want to solve this problem. They want to have both. They want to have the low-wage workers who order their fake social security cards and driver's licenses from China via the internet. And they want to be able to hire those people without any sort of verification system, and to keep that and to suppress wages by hiring the undocumented, while at the same time making a political hay out of the migrant crisis from people who are desperately seeking better lives. It's extremely cynical. And, you know, Greg Abbott is particularly craven in the way that he manipulates this issue to help his friend Donald Trump gain re-election.
So you did not hear how I opened the show. And every day I open the show with something, a quote or a comment or whatever. And there's a interesting article at The New Yorker, and it's about Greg Abbott and the border. But let me just read you the sentence I opened the show with, because I also want people to see the other consequences of this, because you are not going to be protected because you are not an immigrant. You will not be protected because you're not you have a swarthy skin. You will not be. And this is how I start. In the aftermath of the El Paso mass shooting, which was committed by a man fueled by anti-immigration ideology, Abbott had refrained from using words like invasion when he spoke about migrants. These days, it's a word he uses freely. Again, connecting it to what you said, there's something craven and ugly and evil. And going back to what happened in El Paso, what was his motivation? The lies. Okay, he believed the lies, and how many people were murdered as a consequence? You know, that's the part that just sort of horrifies me. And at some point in time, Chris, I would love to know what you think would be, from your perspective, having lived in a place where you really do see the issues and the challenges, how we do begin to repair this issue. I think it's going to get worse because of the climate situation, and you know that, and I know that. And yet at the same time, if it is going to get worse, then we need to be even more prepared to do something that's humane, and to do something that recognizes our physical needs, let alone our emotional needs, and do something where there's a rational gatekeeper. That doesn't mean you open it up for everyone, but that there's a rational gatekeeper. And I would love to know how you think we could approach that, because I think it's important that we begin to put down what we think would work, because it hasn't been adjusted in 40 years. And what we know is 40 years is a lifetime when it comes to how this planet has changed. So I would love to get that. But before I let you go, I want you to talk about Elon Musk and Greg Abbott and what's happening with the billionaire, because this is it's so damn predictable. And you've seen it in so many different ways, but everything that happens in Texas is always bigger. I mean, let's be honest. It's not just that it's Texas. It's the billionaires, the guy who's like, 51st, you know, richest man on the planet, and Elon Musk. So explain to me the relationship between Elon and Abbott, and why what he wants to do, which is expand his SpaceX facility, is something that really is kind of a form of corruption, even if you don't want to use that word, but I will. So please share with my audience a little bit about Musk.
Well, Texas Republican governors pride themselves on how many large corporations they attract to come to Texas. And Greg Abbott has focused on Elon Musk. He's very proud of the fact that Cybertruck is being made outside of Austin. And since then, the Tesla headquarters has moved here. So at one point, Greg Abbott bragged that he talked to Elon Musk once a week on the telephone. You know, this was part of his reelection campaign, was this is how I am boosting the Texas economy. Well, a few weeks ago, we learned that there was this plan afoot by the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department where they were going to trade 43 acres of Texas parkland that's right next to the SpaceX launch pad for 477 acres of land about 10 miles up the coast. Now, mind you, you know, Elon Musk set up his launch pad right next to the state park for a reason. It is on the beach. He can launch his rocket straight over the Gulf of Mexico. But he's running out of land, and so he really needs these 43 acres. So everyone thought this was a good deal, you know, and the head of the Texas Park and Wildlife Department is an oil billionaire named Jeff Hildebrand, and he is the 51st richest person in America with about $13 billion. And this is how he spends his retirement, is getting appointed to these key posts by Greg Abbott.
So what does he know about parkland? I mean, an oil and gas guy. I'm thinking, well, you know, if I was going, what kind of gas should I buy or where should I do? I mean, it's like what is his area of expertise, except does he have checks with commas in them? It sounds like that might be his area of expertise. Am I correct?
Well, his expertise is he gave $750,000 to Greg Abbott's reelection campaign in 2022. You know, that's it. That's his expertise. He also gave hundreds of thousands of dollars to Rick Perry. And so Rick Perry made him put him on the Board of Regents for the University of Texas. This is how billionaires get their payback from their politicians, is by getting these key appointments to these positions.
But are these key appointments, it's interesting, are the key appointments designed so that they can then help the next billionaire who may need access to a parkland? Or is it also designed because they want to, in their retirement or whatever, they want to sort of look at their portfolio and say, look what I did for higher education in Texas. Look what I did for the parklands. Because they don't want to look so craven. Do you know what I mean? It's like, let me do one good thing. I'm not going to get paid much because I don't need the money. But I'm wondering, was the decision to appoint him to be the head of this parkland or whatever it's called, was that done with the knowledge that Elon Musk might eventually want this additional land that basically is in a state park, and therefore he was sort of greasing the skids for Elon Musk? It wasn't necessarily to reward him and his portfolio, but to also sort of lay the foundation to assist Elon Musk.
Well, you know, billionaires have massive egos, and and they are very full of themselves, and you know, would Jeff Hildebrand consider himself a Greg Abbott's lackey? I don't know. I don't think so. I think Jeff Hildebrand probably thinks the opposite is true. But I will note that Hildebrand took this position in August, and by October, they were negotiating with Elon Musk for this land swap. The kicker here, though, is that that land was already being conserved, and that the Conservation Fund was already planning to buy that land to set aside for a federal wildlife refuge. And that's when Elon swept in and purchased the land out from underneath the Conservation Fund. So, you know, it's not even, this deal would only take away acres. It would not add to the total land set aside for parks in Texas. Hildebrand knew this. Musk knew it, SpaceX knew it, Greg Abbott knew it, but they still tried to pass this off as some sort of big step forward for conservation in Texas. But luckily, my colleague here at the Houston Chronicle, Andrea Leinfelder, uncovered it by getting in touch with the locals. And frankly, the locals in Brownsville are growing very tired of Elon Musk and SpaceX.
Yeah, but you write at the end, because with friends like Abbott and Hildebrand, who needs to worry about the public interest or the rule of law? So I guess I'm going to celebrate investigative journalists. Yay, they find corruption. No surprise. You know, and you already know that, I mean, you mentioned that, you know, whose lackey was he? Is Abbott the billionaire's lackey, or is the billionaire Abbott's lackey? I think in the end, they're both Elon Musk's lackey, because they all want to get close to Elon, okay? And they want to do good for Elon. And as much as I see, and I don't blame people for being angry in Texas, in the end, Elon's going to win because it's Texas, because they don't necessarily want to follow the rule of law. Look what's happening at the border with the feds. Rule of law, rule of law. I mean, it's like, you know, that's a suggestion. That's not a law. I mean, let's be honest. That's really what it is. It's about money. It's about political contributions. It's about billionaires being able to sort of hobnob with other billionaires, which they just love. And it's about creating the illusion of an expansion, even when it's not. And what scares me about your story, which is so powerful, is that this land was already in conservation. There's no added value. But how many people will know that aspect of the story as much as they will know that, look what Elon Musk did. He helped expand. I mean, the lie will actually be bigger than the truth. And I guess maybe the point to the community who's so disgusted with this is that their obligation is to make sure they get the truth out as much as possible. Because if it happens to them, it's going to happen to somebody else. And then the question is, are we the land of the free and the brave, or the land of the billionaires? It's surprising, Chris. So what's going to happen now? When are they apparently, a number of people got so upset that they decided to postpone the decision to basically do the swap, whatever that swap was. But they've rescheduled for March. Do they have a bat's chance in hell, or is this going to just basically be, you know, go ahead for Elon?
I suspect it will be a go ahead for Elon. I mean, these folks have never shown much concern about public sentiment. You know, there were 1,600 public, you know, comments posted on this proposal, and 1,300 were opposed. The local community is opposed. But, you know, we are talking about one of the poorer parts of, you know, the less wealthy parts of Texas. We're talking about a part that is 90% Hispanic, and a place where, you know, the only time that Abbott and Hildebrand would ever visit would be as guests of Elon Musk at the fancy SpaceX launch pad. Unfortunately, none of these politicians are up for reappointment or reelection in this cycle. Right. And they know that this will probably be forgotten by 2026.
I guess I have one quick question. So when Elon established this location for his SpaceX, did he always have his eye on this additional piece of land? Like, was that part of the understanding? Was that he didn't need to buy it yet, but he knew that eventually he needed. So when he looked at this footprint, but he recognized that he could, like, it was like easy pickings because he could just grab these other 47 acres and then get exactly what he wanted. So he put his toehold in into what he could acquire, okay, without making people hysterical, knowing full well that he would basically sort of invest in a couple of billionaires and a couple of governors, and that eventually he would get the 47 acres he needed no matter what.
Absolutely. He started out with a very small footprint. You know, Brownsville was initially considered a location for Cape Canaveral because of its location as the southernmost point in the United States. It's a good place to launch rockets from. But I think even Musk did not understand how big SpaceX would become and how important the Brownsville area would be to him and the company. And so he's been gobbling up acres wherever he can. He's begun buying city blocks in Brownsville, which is about a 45-minute drive away. And honestly, you know, this part of the country has never seen this kind of economic development. So in many ways, it is good for the community. It's creating jobs. But there is this fundamental tension between this environmentally sensitive area with a national wildlife refuge and a state park, and the desire to launch the world's largest rocket from the middle of it all. So it's going to be an ongoing story for sure.
Well, we'll be calling you. This is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We're talking with Chris Tomlinson. He is a writer for the Houston Chronicle. The most recent piece we've been talking about is Abbott-appointed billionaire helping Elon Musk acquire sensitive Texas parkland for SpaceX. Blow me away with a feather. Thank you so much, Chris, for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, everyone. We will schmooze tomorrow. Ciao.